91.3 KXCI Tucson. Real people, real radio. Hello, Tucson. Thanks for joining us on this Sunday after Inauguration Day. This is Kathy Harris with my co-host,
Aspen Green.
And we're bringing you Broad Perspectives Radio, a program by women, about women, but for everyone. Well, we're starting a new chapter in our nation, and we're pretty excited about it. I know some people out there are not necessarily happy about the new administration, but that's democracy, isn't it? Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And we did have a lovely transition to the new president this past Wednesday, despite the terrible events of the previous week. And our democracy stands, as always. And today we have a fascinating woman here to help us through any stress and enrich our spiritual and mental well-being. And that is Tucson's own Amy Weintraub. Aspen, tell us about Amy.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. Amy Weintraub is the founder of the Life Force Yoga Healing Institute, an acclaimed yoga therapist and a pioneer in the field of yoga and mental health. Author of the best-selling Yoga for Depression and Yoga Skills for Therapists, she teaches and guides thousands of practitioners and therapists around the world. She thrives in Tucson, Arizona, where she mountain bikes, dances, writes, and creates. In 1999, Amy wrote The Natural Prozac, Yoga Journal's first article addressing yoga and mental health. Her latest offering, Yoga for Your Moon Deck, 52 Ways to Shift Depression and Anxiety, will be released by Sounds True in the spring of 2021. Today, Amy discusses the release of her latest book, a novel called Temple Dancer. The book was 26 years in the making. Welcome to our show, Amy.
Thank you so much, Aspen and Kathy. It's really a pleasure to be here. I've been an on and off listener for so many years, and I don't think I've ever joined you on the show.
Thank you. We ran into each other in the airport about a year ago, and I said, oh, Amy, I need to have you on the show. But so it's been in the making for a long time. So I know your career started as a fiction writer. What were you writing about at that time?
Years ago, I wrote sort of domestic novels set in places like Boston Tanglewood Institute in the Berkshires about classical musicians, psychiatrists acting out with patients, dysfunctional relationships. So I was writing novels and short stories. My short stories were published, but some of them were, but my novels never were. And I suffered from depression, not just as a result of rejections from New York, but from a lot of conditions that led up to serious depression.
You know, I've heard you talk about Dharma. I've listened to your talks a few times. In relationship to your return to writing fiction novels, is Dharma kind of what our truth is?
Yeah, it literally means duty. It's our duty, but it's our spiritual duty. Why are we on the planet? What were we born to do? For me, as a young child, I was an avid reader, and I felt this calling to write. And even as a young child, poetry and stories, I really saw myself. I studied in that direction, MFA in fiction, that sort of thing. So I really geared myself to that kind of work. So that was my Dharma.
In 1994, you went to India and you had a very personal experience or response to a picture of a little girl. Explain a little bit about the tradition Devadasi, so perhaps we can understand what drew you towards telling Sarasvati's story in Temple Dancer.
What I discovered, let's go to the little girl and then I'll talk about Devadasi's. So I was visiting an Indian feminist who had written a novel called The Purple Sea. We were in her office and she had showed me a calendar that she and other feminist women who were concerned about the beady rollers, who the little cigarettes, who were dying of various lung issues because they were doing it in unventilated areas. And it was in the state of Karnataka. And they did a beautiful calendar with pictures. And I was leafing through the pictures, and there was a picture of an 8-year-old girl with knots in her hair. And what that meant was she was going to be dedicated to the goddess Yalama. And at that point, the Devadasi tradition had already been decimated. Devadasis were temple dancers. You can kind of understand them like geisha. They were well educated. They were strong. They were taught Sanskrit and other secular subjects. They amassed many fortunes because they were also like geishas. They had patrons. And so their patron might be the Maharaja of the village, or it might be a wealthy farmer. So they amassed cattle, gold, land. They were prestigious women in the community. They were servants of God. So they saw it as a spiritual, sacred sexuality. They honored the temple gods and goddesses. They put them to bed at night. They did rituals in the community. They were auspicious women, valued by the community. And that culture was decimated in 1947. They were thrown out of the temples. And a lot of them, not all of them, but some of them had no recourse. They were unchaste. They couldn't get married. So if they couldn't teach, and the schools that were founded to save the Bharatanatyam form of dance, classical Indian dance, hired the male dance masters, not the women Devadasi. Some of them became prostitutes, sex workers. I'd learned all this after I was struck in my friend Ambe's office, and tears welled up when I saw this 8-year-old. And I said, I have to know about this. I have to know. And I didn't do the research right away. What came to me when I came back to New England, where I was living at the time, was this voice of an 8-year-old. She just talked through me. I kind of was like taking dictation. I've never written that way before. It's always been literary novels, psychological novels. And this was this pure voice of a Devadasi, a young 8-year-old beady roller who grows up to become a Devadasi. I gave you more than you asked. But
no, that's fabulous. Why did you think it took you 26 years to complete this book?
Thank you for asking that question. I wish it hadn't taken me 26 years. What happened was the voice came through me. It was so pure. And I wrote an American frame around it, and I threw it away. It wasn't good enough. I wrote another American frame around it, and I threw it away. It wasn't good enough. I finally sold the Life Force Yoga Healing Institute to Rose Cress. So I no longer had the administrative duties of running a training program for mental health professionals and yoga teachers. So I had more time, and I went back to writing fiction. I had been writing nonfiction books like Yoga for Depression and other things, but I really wanted to follow my dharma, my personal dharma of coming back to fiction from a place that was happier, more content, not full of the angst of the depression I had carried for most of my life. And out of that came the third structure that surrounds the pure tale of Saraswati, which is her tale is about 120 pages. And then the rest of the novel is about Wendy, who meets an elderly woman, very ethereal, on a train in India, and is left with what appears to be a diary.
Okay.
And that diary is in Kannada, so she has to get it translated. And it's lost in translation for 20 years.
So yoga is also a part of this story, and Wendy is a serious student of yoga and meditation. Where did that character, Wendy, come from? Is there any part of you in her? I had to ask that, being the yoga connection.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about fiction. It gives you the opportunity to create characters, but mine psycho-emotional truths. So ask the deeper questions. Whereas, you know, if you write memoir, you're usually a little more protective because it's supposed to be true. So for me, writing fiction is deeper and more intimate and mining the kernel of truth. So Wendy is not me. I've made mistakes in my life. I have regrets. I have remorse. Wendy's mistakes are not my mistakes, but they gave me the opportunity to dive deep, to understand. And then in terms of the yoga, yeah. So I've been a yoga practitioner for well over 30 years and, you know, a teacher as well. Wendy isn't a teacher, but she's a clinical social worker who was a fine artist who rolled up her canvases, put away her paints because she felt she wasn't a good enough mother. There were some incidents with her daughter where she was so absorbed in the trance state of creating art, as we all know, is akin to meditation, that absorbed state. And she was in that absorbed state, didn't respond to her daughter, and felt horrible about it. So she studies to be a clinical social worker and does a lot of work with women who all feel they're not good enough moms. You know,
I can relate to that.
yeah. So what it looks like and looks at is that trance state. So Saraswati gets into those trance states through the dance, through meditation. Wendy does as well, but Wendy's also a fine artist. So what it looks at those portals into that collective unconscious in Jung's terms, or the divine, that energetic flow through character, through events, we dive deep into that creative trance state where we are in unity. And I love to be able to say that word right now after Wednesday's wonderful events and celebration. We are in unity. And it starts right here with ourselves, finding that way in.
Thank you. I do feel that way. Boy, that was a really feel-good day on Wednesday. You talk about yoga being your medicine. How did you get into the world of yoga, and specifically yoga for depression?
I had been a meditator for a number of years. I had a mantra, but I still suffered from depression. And it wasn't until I found a physical practice. And I did a little bit of asana in between when I would go on rounding weekends, transcendental meditation rounding weekends. But I doing it out of a book or handouts. And it wasn't until I went to Kripalu Center back in the 80s in the Berkshires in New England that I felt transformed. I had been on medication for probably 8 or 9 years. I had been in psychotherapy for at least that many years, probably longer. And it wasn't until I did the breathing, the meditation, the chanting, the physical aspects of asana and pranayama, which are part of the yoga toolbox, so to speak, that I began to feel better. And little by little, with supervision of a psychiatrist, I was able to titrate off the medication that I had been on for years. And that happened in 1989, and I haven't been on medication since. And that's why I say yoga is my medicine. It releases, it deconstructs. We all have stress. We all have betrayals in our lives. We all have losses in our lives. We all have major challenges in our lives. What yoga does is gives us the space to allow ourselves to come back to who we are beneath all that, that sense of wholeness. And if we tap into that, it's a window.
That's fabulous. I need to do more yoga in my life. Well, let's take a little music break right now, and we'll come back and talk more about the book and your workshops coming up. And
I think that's excellent. And today we have such a beautiful song that Amy has chosen. It's called Song of the Soul by Chris Williamson, who's fabulous. Do you want to say something about why you chose the song, Amy?
Back in the 70s, it was an anthem for me. It was beautiful. It touched me at a deep spiritual level, and it connected me to my fellow women friends. There's got to be a better word than fellow. But that sense of deep connection with my community of like-hearted, like-minded women in the 70s. And she just sings to me through that.
Yeah, and let me just mention, Chris Williamson is such an amazing person. She's a feminist singer-songwriter, and she was awarded in 2019 the Lifetimes of Achievement Award from the Americana Music Association for establishing, with Judy DeLugas, the first woman-owned, woman-focused national recording company, Olivia Records, back in 1975. So on many levels, this is a perfect song for today. So let's listen to Song of the Soul by Chris Williamson from her CD, The Changer and the Changed, which is one of the best-selling independent releases of all time. KXCI Tucson, and we're continuing our discussion today with Amy Weintraub.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the book Temple Dancer. The book takes you on a journey between past and present and a mysterious encounter between two women. I've heard you say that the novel begins and ends with fire. That really makes me curious. Can you tell us about that?
There's a mysterious moment at the very beginning in the prologue that really isn't in Saraswati's life. It isn't really explained until, and it still isn't fully explained until the very end of her portion of the novel. Fire also represents that light that shines through us that is never dimmed. And because of Saraswati's story, I was looking for a cover for the book.
That was going to be my next question.
Oh,
perfect.
Okay. Yeah. The cover is a shimmering artist's rendition of fire. It's actually a painting on copper, and then it's fired itself. And it is by Rosanna Marmont, who is a local artist, and she also, I believe, lives in Calgary. I saw it at her opening here in Tucson, and it was like, I was stunned. I said, I would like to have that for the cover. We negotiated, and I got it for the cover. And then I said, no, I want it on my wall. So I also live with it, and it's a stunning painting, and it really represents kind of the fire of the passion of the novel. There's a lot of physical romantic passion. It's not a romance novel, but there's the passion of love. There's the passion of devotion. There's the passion of the dance. There's the passion that we bring to all of the arts. So fire for me represents that passion. It also is a cleansing element. It cleanses the palate. So when I lead a meditation, there's often a sense of light or a candle or fire burning at the brow point, releasing whatever obstructs, whatever clouds of unknowing move in, whatever is not serving us. So fire for me, it's always been a cleansing part of my own practice.
You know, I've heard you talk a lot about how yoga is related to the expressive arts and even psychotherapy. Is it in relating to the expression of self? Is that what you're saying?
That's part of it, yeah. When we practice yoga, if we do so with attention to sensations, which keeps us fully present, not ruminating in our mind, and the breath, we're given the opportunity to really come home to a place of self with a capital S. And it's in those states of connection, of deepest connection, whether you call it divine or whether you call it collective unconscious, it's that state of receptivity. And so when I personally practice yoga, I ask for clarity, creativity, focus to flow through me. And that enables me to be more focused when I come to right. From a standpoint of creativity, it clears away the clutter. So we're less distracted and it brings us home. And then from the standpoint of psychotherapy, it works beautifully as a kind of adjunct practice. Many psychotherapists incorporate the tools of life force yoga into their sessions because it helps connect. It's the love in the room. I mean, what heals us in psychotherapy? It's not the modality, whether it's ACT or IFS or CBT or, you know, all the different modalities of many of psychotherapy. It's the relationship. And these tools, these little breathing practices, the mudras, which are hand gestures, mantras, bring a sense of connection. And that is what helps people heal the most.
Fabulous.
Aside from the evidence, you know, plenty of evidence, you know, but I'm talking about the deeper level of healing.
Like all of us, you know, you've been affected by the pandemic, and I know you teach a lot of classes and you do a lot of workshops and you do some of that back east. How has the pandemic affected you since you're not able to travel back east right now?
Yeah, I'm not traveling. I am doing a few workshops online. So I have one coming up, I think the weekend of February 7th, that anyone anywhere can take. It's being hosted by Yogaville in Virginia, which is where my novel is set, by the way. Part of it, the 2016 portion, set at Yogaville. So that's coming up. So I do things online. I do trainings online for yoga therapy trainings for mental health professionals and yoga professionals. And then I have a weekly class I just started last week. Anyone can join. It's being hosted by Soul of Yoga. You can access it through my website to register. I teach it for 45 minutes once a week.
Is this for beginners as well? Somebody who hasn't done it?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not just sitting there in silence. It's not just mindfulness arises, but it gives the mind a bone. So we do practices that allow the mind to focus, mudras and mantras. People could sign up for it through my website, I believe, amyweintraub.com. But that's once a week. And then there are on my YouTube channel, Amy Weintraub, author, we've been doing a series of remote relief practices. So that's for the pandemic. They're free. You can go on and just practice 5 minutes, 8 minutes, 10 minutes, just to paradigm shift in the mood.
So and that's right something now, we all need right now. That is for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Amy. We're out of time. I'm so proud that you live in our town now because you're such a great asset. You offer so much to us in our community. And I want to say, if you're interested in divine connection or you just a really powerful story of women from very different cultures, I highly recommend Temple Dancer. This is a book that does change your life. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about what I love. Yoga and writing.
It's been delightful to have you, Amy. I'm glad that we got a chance to know you a little better and your wonderful work. And thanks to all of you out there for listening to us on this Sunday. Please join us every Sunday at 3 o'clock for Broad Perspectives Radio, a program by women, about women, but for everyone. And right now, stay tuned because next up we have Amanda Schauger with 30 Minutes. Have a great Sunday.